Thank you very much, Nick. And now it's over to weatherman Tomasz Szafranecker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
It's much colder in Europe, and we've been expecting some snow in the Alps. Still very early in the season as far as skiing is concerned, mostly the so-called freeze-thaw conditions. But I think I'll have a look at a couple of resorts for you, see what's going on. So Switzerland and Zermatt, at the low levels, it's still a mix of rain and snow right through Wednesday night. It will turn colder eventually after Wednesday night, around minus 6 degrees, but it's the top levels, that's where it's all happening. About 10 centimetres of snow expected in Zermatt Wednesday night, and temperatures will dip down to minus 13 degrees. Kitzbühel in the Austrian Alps, the lower levels, well, it's pretty much rain, temperatures above zero, you can forget it. Again, it's at the top levels where the temperatures are just about hovering below freezing, and we're expecting around 7 centimetres of snow. And across most of the Alps, we'll get about 10 or 15 centimetres, so not an awful lot, and it's mostly right at the top. So overall, the snowfall isn't something to get too excited about just yet in the Alps. So that autumn chill across Europe right now. We've just had a whopping cold front sweep across Europe in the past couple of days, but glorious autumn sun should be out across most of Western and Central Europe. So let's take a look at Thursday's weather then. For London, sunny skies and 11 degrees, but cold. Paris, beautiful autumn sunshine and 12 Celsius. In Stockholm, a little bit colder, but still sunny at around 8 degrees. So that's the general picture across western parts of the continent here. How's air travel looking across Europe? If you're flying from London to Zurich, beautiful flying weather, light winds, great visibility. If you're flying from London across the Atlantic, a little bit more bumpy, a very powerful 300 kilometer an hour jet stream close to Newfoundland through Thursday and into the weekend. So whether you might be off to Chicago, Toronto, or the Big Apple, it'll probably take an extra hour with that big headwind. Now let's have a look at the United States, because Wednesday and Thursday look like the worst days as far as the stormy weather goes across the eastern half of the US. Lots of heavy rain about, and all along the eastern Atlantic coast, Washington has already had a soaking. The worst of the weather is now heading for the Great Lakes region, and because of strong winds, bumpy flight conditions between Dulles Airport, Chicago O'Hare, Toronto Pearson International. And if you're traveling across the Atlantic, on a positive side, a jet stream should be in your favor during Wednesday and Thursday, so flights to Europe may be just a tad quicker. Let's check out some city forecasts across the US. New York City on Wednesday, wet, 18 degrees, but on Thursday, it should be sunny and 19. Dallas, both Wednesday and Thursday, is looking sunny with highs of 21. And in Los Angeles, cloudy at times at least, with a modest high of around about 19 degrees Celsius. So that's the weather. I'm meteorologist Tomasz Szafranecker here on Monocle 24.
And I'm Nancy Durham, and I'm here with Rob Bound. And it's a very autumnal day in London today.
I'm loving it, Nancy. By the way, thanks very much for having me on your show.
Thank you for coming to my show.
It's warmed up in here, hasn't it?
My show today.
It is. Who's been your favourite editor?
Oh, obviously you.
Yes! I've won already, and it's only Wednesday.
Tyler.
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah. But okay, the check's in the post on that
I'm
one.
I'm very glad you're here.
Well, really, thanks for having me. Right, it's a brisk one out there.
Yeah, I like it.
And I'm all sort of huddled up in my winter woolies.
It's a lovely navy knit.
In my leather arm patches.
I didn't see those, but it's very because this monitor's in the way. Very smart. Very
oh, you've
smart.
Got your call center monitor there in the way.
Yeah. Yes,
and then I'm in the studio, and Nancy Durham's stripping off. There's been flesh revealed. It's going to be a very, very cultural show.
I have too many layers of wool today,
Steady.
So I had to remove one.
Steady. What about Nicholas and Carla Bruni? I like that little last news story that Nick delivered to us. I was wondering when Nicolas Sarkozy flies to Frankfurt today or tomorrow to meet with Angela Merkel, well, it must make small talk a lot easier between world leaders when one of them's having a baby, right?
Now, I have to admit something. I was just being talked to and I missed the punchline there.
Sorry. Oh, dear. But come on. Now, I wonder whether it makes small talk a lot easier between world leaders when one of them's wives is expecting a baby, right?
That is an excellent observation, but at the same time, picturing Angela Merkel and Sarkozy talking babies,
yeah,
it's kind of difficult.
You don't think Ange has got it in her?
She's a mother, right?
Yeah, I think so.
So, you know,
But I think the world of small talk, it gets pretty grim when it's sort of like there's a big European recession and they're the two people that are supposed to fix it.
I do.
And
they
must be like, oh, what are you going to call him?
Exactly.
What are you going to call him? I think that's even for a German Chancellor. I think that's all right, isn't it?
I think it's totally all right. And then we'll see what he says. And the world's their oyster. French name, Italian name.
Yeah, they could do all sorts of things, couldn't
little
they?
German name just to be friendly.
Cozy Sarkozy.
With the neighbors.
Cozy Sarkozy. Very that's sweet. A good name.
But it's sort of reminiscent of the Tony and Cherie baby time, isn't it? Babies born in.
Well, yes, indeed. But luckily, well, hopefully, presumably, in Carla's memoirs, she won't tell us where it was conceived. We don't ever want to think of that hotel room room in Balmoral Castle, do we?
I don't think so. We don't want too many details, but I think they will emerge.
I think we're dragging this cultural theme through the mud already, Nancy.
I think we are too. And on that note, I'm going to move us on, if I may, and say that on this hour of Monocle 24, it is California, here we come. Well, sort of. We'll find out more about that in a second. The West Coast contemporary art scene takes on New York. And inspired by this month's Monocle picks, we have music to make you smile and we have beautiful books. Forget highbrow or lowbrow. The fabulous Nobrow will be in studio with us. We call them the London company that's putting the love back into books.
That's a great script. Who wrote that?
I did.
It's very good.
I didn't write it. I just said it just then. I believe you are going to take us to L.A. In a way, almost, where contemporary art is really rocking that West Coast.
I certainly am, Nancy. It's the scene and the place to be seen, perhaps right now in the world of contemporary art, is Los Angeles. The November issue just out reveals a sprawling city over 500 square miles with gallery after gallery of new and fabulous art. And the galleries are pretty smart, too. They're using outdoor spaces and indoor party palaces, and all of this during the time when Pacific Standard Time is a sort of mega art event, which has just begun. On the line, luckily, we have Bettina Korek, who's the editor of ForYourArt.com, which chronicles LA's art life. Hello, Bettina.
Hello.
How are you doing? Actually, you slightly ruined my introduction because I think you're on the phone from New York City today, aren't you?
I am in New York today.
So you're in a good position to tell us first, what's the big art difference between the East Coast and the West Coast?
Well, I think that the geography of Los Angeles has also, as always, helped characterize the art scene there, which is it's a very open, spread out city, and that's part of what allowed so many diverse movements to happen, which is what Pacific Standard Time is really focusing on. The LA movements don't fall into these very neat categories in the same way that they do in New York.
And is it something to do with the sprawlingness of the city and the light? Does it make it presumably attract a different sort of artist, does it, to the ones that maybe are holed up in a garret in Williamsburg in New York City?
Absolutely. There's a lot. LA is known for a lot more experimentation, and you know the tidy categories that dominated New York, like minimalism and pop. We don't kind of see that in the same way in Los Angeles. And Pacific Standard Time covers things from ceramics and design and architecture to painting and sculpture and performance art. But what really strikes you is how these artists were crossing so many boundaries.
And Los Angeles has obviously been a powerhouse of the entertainment industry. Hollywood's a byword for it. But why has it taken so long for the art world to get its act together on the West Coast?
Well, I think people don't realize that Los Angeles is a relatively young city culturally. The Los Angeles County Museum of Art really only split from the Natural History Museum, I believe, in 1965. So I think what we're seeing is a maturation of the ecosystem that is, you know, been a long time coming. And the entertainment world is a very sophisticated community. And in the recent, you know, there was just the announcement that the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has entered into a conversation with the LA County Museum of Art to have their museum on site. And I think that that's symbolically a huge moment for Los Angeles, because you're going to have the entertainment community and the art community coming together in this same kind of town square. So it's not that LA has taken so long to get its act together, it's just a much younger city, and the entertainment community dominates the creative scene in a way that the art community does in New York.
And does the art scene in LA, does it learn from the movie industry? Are there elements of we talked about pop art before and sort of using big canvases and big skies? Does the movie industry tap into the art at all?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that you do have some crossover of people from the movie industry coming into the art world. I think what's so fascinating that's happening now are there younger artists like Alex Israel, who is actually making his work from the Warner Brothers set creators. So he goes to Warner Brothers and commissions the same people who create sets for movies to make his work. So I think that, you know, we're actually beginning to see artists approaching the resources that the entertainment industry provides in a new way.
And we think of various cities, I mean, in London ourselves and in New York and various art cities around the world, the gallery scene, depending upon the part of town they're in, is a pretty small world. There's the East End scene in London, there's the Cork Street and Mayfair scene, I guess there's the Soho scene and then the Uptown scene in New York. But how does it work in LA? There's no kind of downtown, is there? Do you still have to drive from one opening to another opening on a sort of hot opening night, or is it starting to become cogent?
Well, there is definitely a critical mass of galleries in Culver City, and I think that LAX Art, the nonprofit space, is a really important pillar in that stretch. And then there are pockets in Hollywood and still further east in Chinatown. So there is that element of driving, but, you know, you can always go to Culver City or Bergamot Station in Santa Monica. There's another great pocket right down the street from LACMA at 6150 Wilshire. And what's been so incredible about Pacific Standard Time is it's brought not only the museums together, but the galleries are collaborating a lot more. There are over 70 galleries that have done shows focusing on this period as well. So you're seeing more and more of the galleries making sure they're all opening on the same nights and making an effort to make it convenient for people to kind of visit more at the same time.
And in terms of galleries collaborating, this presumably is one of the ideas of the big show that we flagged up, Pacific Standard Time. Can you kind of tell us who's behind that and what that sort of aims to achieve?
Absolutely. Well, the main show at the Getty is Pacific Standard Time. It's Cross Currents in LA Painting and Sculpture from 1950 to 1970. And that was curated by Andrew Perchuk, Glenn Phillips, and Ronnie Singh. And that's really an exploration of how painting and sculpture inspired and influenced each other during this time period. And I would say that that's a great exhibition to start with. And then from there, you can kind of go out across the city. But this is, you know, Pacific Standard Time is an initiative that the Getty really started about 10 years ago, and it's the result of an enormous amount of research.
And are galleries generally, I mean, obviously the big galleries and the big privately funded galleries with wealthy philanthropists' names attached to them, as well as the smaller, more underground gallery scene, are they all happy to collaborate? Are they all happy to sort of pull together to make a name for LA art right now?
Absolutely. And what's been so incredible is how the bigger museums, LACMA, MoCA, The Hammer, the Santa Monica Museum, have made such an effort to help highlight shows that are happening at their smaller counterparts. So I think that you've seen the entire landscape really elevate in this coming together.
And I wanted to ask you quickly about collectors as well. I guess it takes money, obviously, to make the whole thing sing. Michael Ovitz, who was at Disney, who's the kind of Hollywood connection, and then Eli Broad is building his own museum. I understand. Are these places with private money involved? Are they sort of important for sort of getting bums on seats or certainly bodies into gallery spaces?
Well, I think that this is really a global trend that we're seeing more and more collectors open independent spaces, but at the same time, they're maintaining relationships with museums, and this is an area that's going to be really interesting to watch, which is how will these independent museums continue to relate to their public counterparts. And I think that, you know, the new Broad Museum is scheduled to be on Grand Avenue right near MoCA and Red Cat. And these are organizations that are already talking about how they're collaborate. So, you know, again, it's about coming together and leveraging all of the attention that they can create collectively to benefit everyone.
Cool. Thanks, Bettina. I just wanted to ask you very briefly before we go about foryourart.com. It's sort of boosting its coverage, isn't it? I mean, it's obviously a huge city to cover in terms
Absolutely.
Of the art. You must burn a lot of petrol and wear out a lot of soles of shoes.
Can
you
I do.
Tell us about how the site works very quickly?
Well, our goal is really to curate opportunities for people to see, learn about, collect, and especially support art in Los Angeles. So we try to edit all of these things that are going on and make it a lot more digestible for people who aren't spending all of their time going to every gallery and museum. And we're going to be expanding to New York early next year, which is very exciting. And, you know, but there's content on the site now that's great for people who live anywhere. Particularly, we focus on editions that you can buy that support public art projects. So I think people don't realize that there's so many ways to collect great artists and also support projects.
Bettina Couric, editor of foryourart.com. She's doing it so you don't have to, driving around LA looking at great paintings. Bettina, thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Brilliant. Very interesting.
She was good, wasn't she, Bettina?
Yeah, she was. And there's just an overwhelming amount of variety and location. And
yeah.
I do have this picture of people driving around in their open-top big Cadillacs
right.
going from art gallery to gallery. I like this one that's in Monocle this month, Night Gallery. They stay open till 2 or 3 in the morning.
And, I know, it's cool, isn't it?
And it's kind of wedged like between an onion ring and taco stop and a... I don't know, running shoe store. Or
this
something.
This is sort of where new galleries should be. And I like the way that the Night Gallery. I'm slightly confused at it, but I like it. Presumably they just show neon works.
Yeah,
right.
They're open in the daylight too, but maybe they get really neon
paintings in the daytime, neon at night.
And they do sort of happenings in there. I think I was seeing a picture of one.
No, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I do like that idea. I think there is a different complexion to art from Los Angeles. David Hockney, I think when he went there, he just couldn't believe how big the skies were. And he did the first thing he did when he sold a painting there was buy a convertible, learnt to drive, bought a convertible so that he could go and, immerse himself under these huge skies.
And who captured it better than him, right?
Exactly.
Fantastic.
The big splash.
Excellent.
That's what we're calling the show now.
Okay, and we are going to splash on with some music. I have been, first I want to remind everybody that you are listening to Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham, and I'm calling you Monocle's Mr. Culture, Rob Bound.
They'll write in and complain about that, you know.
Okay, well we need people to write in. Rob, I've been reading your music reviews, and as a result, I really want to hear some music from you, and I think you have a selection.
I do. I've come in with 3 CDs under my arm. The first one, they're all from the magazine. We've got Piney Gurr. I think that's how you pronounce her name. Piney Gurr, who's a bit of a kind of country girl, although she's a sort of multifarious talent. And this is Olies.
She's lovely.
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah, and lovely little rattlesnake sounds. I love the little clicks and things.
We need a webcam in here because I was doing the finger clicks and Nancy was doing the castanets during that song.
Yeah, that's what they are. Thank you. Rattlesnakes.
The rattlesnakes. Or the rattlesnakes, as we call them.
Really pretty. And look, you have said, you're quite a writer, aren't you? 40 minutes of dazzling tunefulness, gleeful, wide horizon, jangly guitar, road tripping.
Is that all right?
And she makes you smile, right? Isn't this the one?
Yeah, she does.
She's smiling.
The album's called Geronimo with an exclamation mark on the end of it.
Right.
And I think it sounds like that, right?
Yeah, it does.
Sounds like she's having a eureka moment.
It's wonderful. And you are smiling, and that's great.
And coming up next, Summer Camp, who are a new kind of twosome from Camden.
Hey? That's just down the
That's
street.
That's not even on the script, that stuff. I make that up.
Did you make it up?
Yes. They're a new twosome from London. One of them is Jeremy Walmsley, who purveys what I call stalker pop, slightly.
Oh, sort of scary music.
It's not scary. He's a lovelorn young fellow.
Okay.
And he uses a lot of synthesizers, and it sounds a bit, but it's very good.
Great.
And he's got a new female cohort, and this is their new beginning called Summer Camp, and it's Better Off Without You.
Well, we're tapping our toes and drumming in here.
We like a bit of that.
Yeah, I like
synthy,
it. Good.
Cool. Boy-girl harmonies.
Very
nice.
Cool.
Early 80s style.
I'm liking it.
By the way, it's Jeremy Walmsley and Elizabeth Sankey.
Okay.
I did that research during the song there.
Oh, you're so good.
Yeah.
Take us on to the next one.
It's written on my piece of paper.
Take us on to the next one.
Next, we've got Pink Martini, Portland, Oregon, sort of stalwarts of bossery kind of stuff. And they've teamed up, they've made their career even more interesting by teaming up with Saori Yuki, who's an old kind of like, she's a bit like the Marianne Faithful or something of Japan. Or maybe the Lulu. And this, we can chat about them off
both
the back
good,
of it
both
briefly.
Good.
This is called Mayonaka no Bossa Nova, Midnight Bossa Nova.
Oh, that's very cool. Thank you for the music, Rob Bound, my co-host on Midori House today. Coming up, we'll be joined with Alex Spiro, creative director of No Brow. Pictures of his beautiful books grace the pages of this month's Monocle magazine. That's in a few minutes.
Keep abreast of everything from breaking news to fresh business opportunities with Monocle 24's lineup of live weekday current affairs programmes. The Globalist kicks off our day at 6 a.m. UK time with 2 hours of news, media reviews, weather and reports from our correspondents around the world. At midday UK time, The Briefing helps the North American East Coast get into gear with a brisk review of news and analysis. And at 18:30 UK, Midori House gets a first read on stories hitting Asia's front pages and does a roundup with Monocle's editors. Finally, the Monocle Daily signs on for 2 hours at 2200 with a mix of our editors and special guest anchors to start the day in Asia. Keep an eye and an ear on the world, right here on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
The Propa Jalavert, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det her Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And now it's time for some news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Nancy. Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Greek police cleared the square in front of Parliament today after clashing with black-clad demonstrators during a mass anti-austerity rally called to coincide with a vote on a bitterly resented new round of belt tightening. President Obama has condemned a Kurdish assault that killed 24 Turkish soldiers as an outrageous terrorist attack. Egyptian presidential candidate Amr Moussa has said he feared a prolonged transition to civilian rule could plunge Egypt into anarchy caused by spiralling violence and economic hardship. US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has arrived in Kabul, where she's due to meet with Afghan President Hamid Karzai and other key political leaders. Libyan interim government fighters relaunched their offensive on the besieged town of Sirte today after being pushed back by die-hard Muammar Gaddafi loyalists holed up in the deposed leader's hometown. Yemeni tribesmen blew up an oil export pipeline in oil-producing Marib province east of the capital Sana'a. The attack on the pipeline, which carries crude oil from Marib to export facilities in Ras Issa on the Red Sea, is the fifth of its kind in a month. The European Union's executive has set out plans to invest €50 billion by 2020 in new cross-border transport, energy and broadband projects, which it said could boost growth and employment in the 27-nation bloc. Major donors to Ivory Coast are in talks with President Alassane Ouattara to urge him to draft a plan for badly needed reforms to his security forces and turn an undisciplined mix of soldiers and former rebels into a professional force. The United States and North Korea plan to meet on Monday and Tuesday in Geneva. A source familiar with the matter said for discussions likely to focus on whether North Korean denuclearization talks might resume. The French First Lady Carla Bruni was believed to be close to giving birth to her first child with husband President Sarkozy on Wednesday in what would be the first baby to be born to a French presidential couple in office. And dozens of large exotic animals, including tigers, lions and bears, were hunted down and shot after their owner opened their cages at his Ohio farm and then killed himself. Those are the top stories at the top of the hour. Well, not the top of the hour, the bottom of the hour, here on Monocle 24. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Nick. Now,
we're a bit more chilled out at the bottom of the hour, aren't we?
We are even more chilled. Is. We're past the bottom of the hour. It's all chilled in here now. Thank you very much for that. Yeah. No Brow, what a clever name for a publisher who wants to get everyone under the covers of his books. They're not highbrow or lowbrow, and they are stunning. No Brow is quality publisher, or a quality publisher, in London's East End, and Monocle loves them. And Alex, you're with us. Nice to have you here.
It's nice to be here. Thank
and
you.
I just have to say, as we're really thinking Monocle and we are Monocle 24, you know, you are proof, like the magazine, that paper is here to stay.
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of, like a lot of people interested in publishing, we saw a trend recently, well, before we started, towards digital publishing. And we were very keen to sort of exist after, well into that move and also afterwards. So our starting point was to print things that we felt deserved to be printed. That is to say, they weren't things that were being printed merely for their didactic or entertainment sort of led content, but because they were in themselves beautiful objects to collect, to cherish, to pass down through generations. And we create books to that end. It's been two and a half to 3 years, depending on how you look at it. And we've published over 30 titles. So,
but you started with a magazine twice a year, and now look at you. You have an empire, a little empire here.
Hardly, but we're working hard. That's for sure.
And Rob must come.
I like the sound of books that you can hand down from generation to generation. He's creating heirlooms.
Yeah,
that's what he's doing.
Yeah.
And they smell amazing as well. In Tom Morris's piece in the magazine, I think there's a quote about trying to get as much ink on the page as possible.
Yeah.
And you've obviously brought in a selection of titles, and they look absolutely stunning, and they look bright, and they look amazing. The illustrations, the typography, it just all jumps off the page and off the front covers. But also the smell, that smell of ink that you kind of gets rarer and rarer, the thinner and cheaper books get.
Yeah.
I suppose it's all elements of the tactile nature of books that you're gunning for, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. We actually print using a technique that isn't widely used these days. We print using spot colours almost exclusively. And that's to say that we're using specific Pantone colours to create all of the imagery in the books. Now, first of all, that means that we have a handle on the separations, the printing separations. So we're very much tied into the printing process. And it also means that we determine what the ink coverage is on the page, the percentages, along with the artist's collaboration. And that's really what makes them smell so strongly. And also
the depth of colour
and just the fact that they are they're just covered in ink.
And they're heavy. I mean, they're heavy with colour.
Yeah,
right?
No, they are.
And that's
because
of this process.
Yes,
that hardly anybody is doing.
Yes, there's a publisher in Germany called Die Bücher de Gutenberg that uses it with their Tolle Hefte series. But other than them, there's us and a few other people who do it. It's actually a much more old school way of printing, and that's what we wanted to get back to. We've had our success in a large part due to the internet, because we managed to ride out hard times with our web shop, which is very successful. So we're by no means Luddites, as far as the books are concerned, we wanted to bring back the same sort of ethos of quality that was there in the past.
And it sounds like a risky business. You started up in 2008. We all know what happened in 2008. I think we're still feeling it now. I don't know if there's any different. But that's a risky business to set up something that is kind of niche, although it's obviously becoming popular and you're becoming known for it. What was the sort of genesis of it? I know you and Sam, your cohort, are ex-St. Martin's graduates, right? But where did it kind of start off?
Well, I was working for Sam. He's a commercials and music video director. I was working for him as an assistant, backgrounds, animations, things like that. And we'd spoken for a long time about wanting to do something together, something different, you know. And we were both big fans of print, and we were also big fans of comics and illustrated books. So it kind of started there. And by the time we were about to start, the financial crisis hit. But we'd already managed to get some money together to start up. And then we just, you know, we just stayed positive, basically. We did what we were doing. We didn't take any massive financial risks at the beginning. We used a screen printing setup to produce a larger library than we could have financially otherwise, by printing them by hand. And then, you know, we kind of used those to go around to the bookshops and show them that we had the potential to produce more. And that's it, really. You know, kind of it grew from there, I suppose.
But right on, that's such a good question, and it makes me wonder, though, was it then nerve-wracking? You had your capital, but it must have taken before people came to buy.
Yeah, no, it was nerve-wracking, but we actually got the first issue of No Brow in the Tate within about a month of releasing it.
Which is a good place to be, right?
Yeah, and I was going around personally with samples and you know, just basically selling it to people. So I did most of the distribution and sales at the beginning. Now, obviously, we have a distributor, so it's a different kind of kettle of fish.
And in terms of selling it, you've got to tell people where to get it. A website, and you're on Great Eastern Street.
Yes, so the website is nobrow.net, and we have a shop, a retail outlet on Great Eastern Street at 62 Great Eastern Street. We're also available through all good comic book shops. And
Are you sponsoring this show now or what?
Sorry.
And what do you find, what works best for you? You obviously get a lot of online orders, presumably from abroad and stuff, but the shop must do well for you. I've been in there and I've walked past it and it looks amazing.
Yeah, the shop's doing great. You know, it helps pay the bills. I'd say online is really the biggest thing, along with selling through bookshops. But now we're distributing our books in France and soon in the States. So hopefully that will add to things.
The one thing I'm just afraid we haven't done enough is to really describe this rich, saturated color, if I can call it that.
But
this is almost like, this is Gertrude Stein. It's almost like a brochure, a pamphlet. But it's exquisite. I can't take my hands off it. I'm trying to keep it very clean and tidy. But what's going on with that? It's wonderful.
Well, this book, Ada, by Gertrude Stein, was illustrated entirely by Attack, who's a German, Berlin-based artist. And he creates all of the separations by hand. He paints them onto film. He's a printmaker, so he's used to screen printing. So he's separated all of the images out into four color separations. And then we've given those separations directly to the printer. So there's actually no half tone in this.
Is it new or is there reproduction in there? I mean,
it's
looks
new.
Like it came out of grandmother's.
It does. It's
chest.
New. It's I mean, it was, this book was actually first published by Die Tolle Hefte and we did the English edition. So it's been out for, I think, about 5 years or so. But our version is only a year and a half old, I believe.
I want one. Aren't they gorgeous?
They're absolutely beautiful. It is beautiful. And it is a cool shop. If you're driving down, even if you're driving down Great Eastern Street, but especially if you're walking down there, you cannot help but see it because it stands out like one of the books itself, the shop.
Fantastic. Well done, you. So nice to meet you and to see these wonderful colors and to hear about your success. Alex Spiro, creative director and co-founder at Nobrow London. Also, what a great name. How quickly did you come up with that? Nobrow?
It's John Seabrook. He writes for The New Yorker. He wrote a book about Nobrow culture, and it was the right name at the right time. I just thought it was a great name for what we wanted to do.
Thank you very much. Well, you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Nancy Durham with Monocle culture editor Rob Bound. In a minute, we'll talk about a book called Eat, Pray, Eat.
From the end of October, you'll be able to download...
Thank you so much. Yeah, you're lovely. Thank
featuring
you.
Featuring our Monocle 24 radio player, daily monocolumn feed, and our global 25-25 City Guide series. With its unique time-shift device to spool through programmes, you can either listen live or catch up on anything you might have missed via our archive. The Monocle app, available from the end of October via iTunes, is brought to you in association with Rolex.
Every month, the Monocle shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, a new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
Well, our own Copenhagen correspondent Michael Booth is the author of Eat, Pray, Eat. And who could not reach for a copy after reading in this month's Monocle?
Oh, the book. Sorry, I was just reading
Thank
it
you,
there.
Rob.
This is that was so live. The book tells the story of Michael Booth embarking on a 3-month trip to India to research a book on cuisine. Halfway through, his wife had enough of his neuroses and excessive drinking and press gangs him into taking a yoga course. The results are hilarious and uplifting. And that's a quote from the magazine.
It is. And it's my turn to say we have our man on the line from Copenhagen now. And Michael, what yoga position are you in as we speak?
Standing, leaning on a doorway in a summer house way north of Copenhagen, actually.
With a beer in one hand?
No, not yet. No.
Michael, it's a nice riff on the Eat, Pray, Love for the title. Did you go to India considering you would eat, pray and eat, or that you'd eat, pray and find spiritual enlightenment?
No, the idea was to eat, and eat. I was going to write a book, a follow-up to the last book I wrote, which was about Japanese food, where I would just, you know, gaily trip around the subcontinent and find fantastic food stories and turn them into a nice little narrative travel book. But that didn't really come to pass in the end.
But it does wonders for the tone of the book, right? To bring a bit more of the personal experience in there. I think, is it a case that sort of India cracks even the hardest food writer?
Yeah, it's exactly that actually, Rob. Yeah, you know, Japan is very very easy in many ways. It's very organised, and if you have the right go between, you can pretty much go anywhere, and everything works and functions. If you go to India, it's not quite the same. But the other big difference was Indian food really happens in private kitchens. It doesn't happen in restaurant kitchens in the same way that it does in Japan. So it was much more difficult to get into. But to be honest, I didn't really even make a good fist of trying to get into it. I kind of fell apart halfway through the trip anyway.
Is that where your wife enters and sorts you out?
Yeah, exactly. It was on a canal boat in the backwaters in Kerala, and she'd seen the signs coming for a long time that things weren't going very well with my work and with my midlife crisis, which was kind of imminent. I was in my late 30s, and it was kind of a one-woman intervention, basically, in which she told me to get a grip, sort myself out, cut back my drinking, cut back my neuroses, and her solution to all of this was to enroll me on a kind of boot camp, a yoga boot camp in Mysore. And it kind of did the trick, actually.
Well, take us there. I mean, I'm really amazed. What did you learn? What was it like?
It was horrifically brutal to start with. You know, to paint you the picture of me physically, I was overweight, incapable of putting a cork in an unfinished bottle of wine, inactive, hadn't done any kind of exercise for years, and then suddenly I found myself in a yoga shala in Mysore with some very hardcore yogis from around the world who had traveled to meet this fantastic young guru who has devised this entirely new kind of yoga. And I was a complete beginner, and it was frankly quite humiliating, really.
But you took to it, and I mean, truly, it sounds as if you did manage to transform your life a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think that's an exaggeration, really. I still practice yoga every day, and also transcendental meditation, both of which I was introduced to in Mysore. I think the main thing was I kind of became aware of my body and what it could do. And as a 39-year-old, it quite surprised me what it was capable of once you broke through that humiliation and pain barrier that I had to get through in the first week or two of the course.
Is this is yoga the sort of last refuge of the food critic and the food writer, Michael, that you can go and have three proper meals a day with the accompanying drinks and then kind of stretch it off at the end of the day?
Well, you know, the first thing this yoga instructor said to me was, I asked him, do I need to change my diet? Do I need to eat anything special? And he kind of shook his head wryly and said, no, you don't need to worry about what you eat. We're going to work you so hard. It doesn't really matter. And initially I thought, oh, great, I can continue eating. But then when he began to work me so hard, I'd realized that, no, and fun enough, my appetite naturally changed. So that within the first week I was eating maybe a bag of nuts and a bit of yogurt every day, having plenty of energy and not feeling hungry. I still can't really explain what happened. It was quite miraculous, actually.
And I wanted to go back to the food in India quickly as well. As you talked about it not necessarily being such a restaurant culture, are people very happy for you to jump in their kitchen or sit around their dining table? Do they take your family in with open arms?
Amazingly so. Much, much more than in Japan. We didn't get into one private home, or not, at least not invited to dinner in a private home in Japan in all the time we were there. In India, we had to fend off the invitations, and people were very happy for me. I was traveling through India with my wife and two young kids, and as soon as they saw my two young, they're half Scandinavian, so they're blonde. As soon as they saw them, it was like going on some kind of royal walkabout, you know. There would be cheek pulling and hair patting, and, you know, it got quite extreme towards the end. But yeah, every door was flung open to us. It was amazing, the hospitality. And the hospitality, I don't know if you've ever experienced it in a Hindu household, is quite something else. They literally consider you as a kind of deity. Like any guest who comes into their house of a devout Hindu is like a deity, and you get treated in that way, which can also be a bit awkward because you end up sitting around the dining table eating while your host
hovering off the ground like a deity.
Not quite, but they don't eat. They wait until you finish eating before they start eating, and it took a while to get used to that.
Well, this is a wonderful journey you were on, and I just have to come back to your wife. She must have been really impressed with you, you know, taking up the challenge.
I think she was, yeah. You'd probably have to ask her that yourself, but I think in the end she was quite pleasantly surprised by what I managed to do, yeah. She also did some amazing things with yoga while she was down there, but we're still together, that's all I can say.
I think this is a wonderful and heartwarming story. Yes, it is uplifting, as it says in Monocle magazine.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it? That's a proper...
heartwarming for cynics.
No, it's just a lovely story. I could hear more. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy.
That's a proper book cover quote, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hilarious and uplifting.
Yeah, I could hear more.
You wrote that yourself, I think, Michael.
No, it's what. Well done, you. I think it's amazing.
Cool.
Thanks.
Well, thanks very much for joining us, and enjoy that
You're
beer.
So welcome.
And enjoy that beer when it finally comes around up in north of Copenhagen.
And maybe you should come here and give us all some yoga boot camp lessons.
Oh, I'd love to. I could show you some moves, Nancy.
I'm waiting. See you soon.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye bye. Bye. So, Michael Booth, our correspondent in Copenhagen. What a nice guy.
I know, that's cool, isn't it? I think it's something for me. I think I've slightly suffered from all of his problems.
And my husband.
The only thing we all spend money on is food and drink, and it'd be kind of nice if all we have to do is kind of like a half lotus, it's about sort of half past 11 before you jump into bed. That'd be all right.
You could
get away with everything.
Yeah, you could really hear the way he took to it. It was lovely, and you're pointing because you're going to cue us.
I am. What are we doing? We're playing another pink martini track, aren't we?
And you know what it's called?
This is Pink Martini and Saurayuki, and it's Puff the Magic Dragon.
And that was Pink Martini.
What's
Puff
the word?
The magic Dragon.
Weirdly, you sounded like you were reading it, but you weren't that time.
Oh, thank you very much.
Come on.
You're so kind.
Puff the Magic Dragon. We found out what it was in French and Japanese there. That was Genki. I know a man that would describe that as Genki.
And that means?
It sounds like a woman wearing it. I think it means kind of cutesy and lovely.
Oh,
I think so.
Very nice.
And it was, wasn't it?
I'm so touched.
Twinkly.
It was pretty. It was like a child song, actually.
How fluffy
I want
do you
to
think,
play that for yeah. little children in my life.
How fluffy do you think Saurayuki's slippers are?
Tell me.
I don't know.
I think, bet they're not made of felt.
I think they're 100% fluffy.
Yeah. Pink? Pink, probably?
Definitely pink. I think they're powdered.
Okay. Well, we are Monocle 24, and you are listening to Nancy Durham and Rob Bound, our culture editor. Very shortly, we're going to have a visit with Tyler Brulé, and... that will be just after this.
From the end of October, you'll be able to download Monocle's first app, featuring our Monocle 24 radio player, daily monocolumn feed, and our global 25/25 City Guide series. With its unique timeshift device to spool through programmes, you can either listen live or catch up on anything you might have missed via our archive. The Monocle app, available from the end of October via iTunes, is brought to you in association with Rolex.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
The Propa Jalavert, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Det är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And it sure is Monocle 24, and it's very nice to have Tyler Brulé with us. And you're going to be on the Monocle Daily this evening.
What do you mean I'm going to be on? I am the Monocle Daily.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Excuse me.
Me and
what about Christine?
Hey, give me a second.
Okay.
Me and Christine O'Cran.
Be nice.
I'm very nice.
I know.
Okay.
You look great. Spiffy suit.
I know. I had to get dressed up today.
You were busy?
I went to Big House in the centre of London.
And was it nice?
It was nice.
Was it?
Yeah.
A very big house?
Very, very big house.
What's it like out the front?
Large barricades, fountain out front. Traffic used to be able to go around it. They've diverted the traffic now. Sometimes there's a big flag fluttering on top.
Is the flag fluttering?
Yeah.
Or no? Oh.
But the guest, the main resident, she's out of town right now. I think she's in Australia.
I didn't realize the American embassy had a
Oh, all right.
Were the
then.
Relatives
the female
there?
Ambassador.
Sorry. Other, were
I was
there?
I was yeah, there were some relatives around. Not my relatives, mind you, but anyway.
Did you have a cup of tea?
I did have tea.
And a little biscuit or something.
Well, you know what the best bit is the biscuits are the ones that family endorses.
Oh,
or makes.
Well, I mean, they've all got royal warrants for different biscuits, but it's the ones that come out of the tin that
yeah,
we all know with the you know the fancy creams and the chocolate covered ones and
past the blank on the left hand side.
Not really Dutchy, no, much more
Yeah, I would say sort of much more ground floor of Fortnum and Mason.
How many did you have? Because when you're a place like that, you don't want to keep going back for more.
No, you don't. I didn't indulge.
Did you dip?
I didn't dip. No.
Straight to the dry biscuit.
I had the tea.
Builder's tea, or was it a little bit of?
No, it was a prop. No, it was nice. It was a nice cup of tea.
Imagine you get it in a paint.
But it looked like
mug.
The particular wing that I was in was like looked like a moving out sale or moving in sale.
Oh, this is. Well, more to come on
more
that.
More to come on this topic.
And we're running out of time.
We are running out of time. Just very quickly, coming up tonight on the Monocle Daily with me and Christine Okrant, we're going to be talking Greece. We're going to be seeing what happened there today. Also, we're going to talk to our correspondent, read the elections in Argentina and many other things across 2 hours.
Thank you very much. Good luck with that. And speaking of talking Greece, you're going to be talking Turkey at some point soon. Rob Bound, quickly.
Talking Turkey, yeah. We're sending one of our correspondents off for a Turkish soap opera lead for next month.
And that's all the time we have today on Monocle 24 Midori House.